It's time for Eco Talk with host Betsy Rosenberg.
She'll be great. She's a very smart, capable person who knows exactly what took place and will lay out the facts. And that's what the American people want to see.
I had a dream the other night. Now, in my dream, our national bird had become the ostrich.
Hello and welcome to another important edition of Eco Talk. I'm going to ask you to buy some stuff. That's unusual for us. We know, not our usual style, but this is good stuff. First, go out and try to find the November 20th issue of New Yorker magazine. It has the latest in a series of stunning articles by environmental journalist Elizabeth Culbert. These articles are Pulitzer Prize worthy, hard science written with the type of observation and telling detail more often found in novels. This should be a book, perhaps her compilation of articles on global warming will be soon. We're very pleased to have her in the first half of today's show. In our second half, we'll be chatting with Felix Kramer, the founder of Cal Cars. He's going to tell us all about the exciting news with plug-in hybrids. And finally, Tamara Raphael of EcoExpress.com will tell us all about some greenish goodies that can nourish and educate your friends and family this holiday season, as well as be little gentler on the earth. We are always bearing gifts here, we like to think, at EcoTalk, even if they are sometimes in the form of information that may disturb the comfortable and comfort the disturbed, those of us who have a lot of eco angst. And now we get a lot of confirmation that it's not our imagination. Things really are quite dire. But what we try to do here is tell you the bad news. And then by enlightening all of us, and we all have a lot to learn, hopefully start getting into action and dealing with some of these eco challenges before they're going to get worse. So without further delay, it is a great honor to welcome to Eco Talk Elizabeth Culbert of course, New Yorker Magazine. Thank you for all your important work.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So this latest article left me totally depressed. And many of your articles do that, but they are so important to understand. And you tell the stories in ways that are really easy for the layperson to digest, difficult emotionally, but just it's easy to understand it as you describe it. Highly recommend it. You start out with a story about these little shelled creatures called pteropods. Is that how you pronounce them?
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Tell us their tale over the past century or so, and why should we tune in to pteropods?
Well, pteropods are tiny little, basically they're marine snails, and they flap around underwater. And there are about 100 species of them, and many of them have these little tiny shells. And what scientists have found who are studying them is that they're very sensitive to changes in the pH. And that brings us back to our high school chemistry class, but to the pH of the water. And what's happening as we add carbon dioxide to the atmosphere is we are actually changing the pH of the oceans. And a lot of creatures, organisms that build shells like pteropods, pteropods are really just one example of really literally thousands of marine species that build shells or skeletons, in the case of coral, say, that are sensitive to changing pH in the ocean.
And some of the research that you cite goes back to the 80s when one woman probably somewhat unknowingly started focusing on them and then went back and developed, you know, this theory about what's happening now.
Right. I mean, what happened, it's a scientist who works out in California at Cal State and named Vicky Fabry. And what happened is she just was collecting pteropods to study how they form their shells. And this was in the 80s, as you say, and she sort of overcrowded them. She put too many in a bottle, and like human beings, pteropods, you know, breathe in oxygen and breathe out carbon dioxide, and the carbon dioxide started to basically build up in the water, and when she went to check on them, she noticed that their shells were starting to dissolve, and that's the effect that this buildup of CO2, which when it dissolves in water, it forms an acid, carbonic acid, which people may also remember from high school chemistry. And it starts to have this effect on some organisms of literally starting, if you get enough in there, starting to dissolve their shells.
And this is because of the process known as ocean acidification. Describe that, if you will, please, and its connection to climate change.
Well, what happens when you put anything into the air, but in this case we're talking about carbon dioxide, is, you know, the oceans and the air and the water is always in an equilibrium. They're always exchanging gases through the surface of the water. And if they're in equilibrium, then, you know, sort of the same amount is coming out of the ocean, the same amount of CO2 would be coming out of the ocean as is going back in. But since we're now pumping so much CO2 into the air, and we're talking about 7 billion metric tons per year as a humanity, that's what we're pumping into the air. more CO2 is going into the ocean than is coming back out. So CO2 is starting to build up in the ocean, just as it was, you know, in those bottles that we were talking about a minute ago. And what happens, as I mentioned, when you put CO2 into water, is you get this acid, carbonic acid. And it's not a very strong acid because we drink it when we drink Coke, for example, or any soda. But if you're living in it all the time, it does have effects.
And one of the other researchers you cited was Ken Caldera. Tell us about his work. Was he looking at the biosphere years after it failed?
That's actually a guy named Chris Langdon.
Okay, who, I got them mixed up. Sorry.
That's okay. A guy named Chris Langdon who went to when Columbia University took over the biosphere, which was, as people may recall, this totally self-enclosed world that was supposed to sort of be the kind of, you know, thing that you could export to Mars if you were going to colonize Mars. And then it collapsed. It sort of failed. And Columbia took it over. And this guy named Chris Langdon, who's a marine scientist, went to figure out what to do. They had created these whole ecosystems in there, and they had created this ocean that had in it a lot of coral. And what he found, and it's a little bit complicated to explain how, but what he basically found, and no one really knew this until this point, which was in the late 90s, early, you know, just about 5 years ago, was that coral is also very sensitive to this chain of reactions that starts when you start pumping, you know, CO2 into the water. And so therefore, the more they pump into the water, the slower the coral grows, until eventually you reach a point where they're not growing at all.
Okay, so it was Ken Caldera who actually looked at different scenarios and decided that even the best was just another flavor of bad in terms
exactly,
of forecast.
Exactly, right. There's a lot of scenarios that climate scientists work with, looking out over the next, basically, you know, 94 years, the year 2100, what are carbon emissions going to look like? And, you know, there's sort of the scenario, well, we actually, you know, try to reduce emissions and we move towards, you know, renewable energy. And then there's the scenario that we do nothing and we continue on our merry way and emissions just, you know, sort of continue to increase on the same trajectory they're on now. And he ran both of all of these scenarios through a model that looked at how the oceans take up carbon dioxide and decided that even, you know, what people would consider to be a sort of an optimistic scenario was terrible as far as the oceans are concerned.
Now, what about coral reefs? It seems like they're becoming the marine canaries in the mine.
Yes, and people do use that term. I mean, coral reefs are, you know, people, you know, sort of can, they're sort of what people, the polar bears, you know, of the underwater, they're sort of charismatic, they're spectacularly beautiful, as anyone who's visited one knows, but they're also incredibly important ecosystems. I mean, there are estimates that somewhere between 1 million and 9 million species are dependent on coral reefs, okay? So we are really talking about a lot of organisms, marine organisms. And coral reefs are really, really in trouble. They're in trouble for a lot of reasons. They're in trouble because of rising water temperatures. People have probably heard about these bleaching events that are taking place. But now it turns out that they are also really in trouble because of the changes that are occurring. As I said, when you start pumping CO2 into the water, their growth is slowing down.
Mm. Thomas,
and eventually, I should also point out that things are always eating away at coral reefs. So if you're not growing, you can't keep up with that, and eventually you just basically collapse.
Someone else you cite in your excellent article is Thomas Lovejoy of the Heinz Foundation. He, I guess, is the one who coined the term biological diversity. Didn't realize
right.
that it came from him. But he describes the effects of ocean acidification as evolution in reverse. I guess we're devolving pretty rapidly here.
Yeah, there's a lot of concern, you know. The oceans have been very stable, basically, for, you know, tens of millions of years. And when you have stable environmental conditions, you evolve these very, very sophisticated, very elaborate food chains. And when you start having instability and you start, you know, basically some of the parts of that food chain fall out, there's a real concern that, you know, the upper end of the food chain is just going to collapse. And so you're going to basically, you're running evolution in favor of more primitive life forms, is his point.
Okay, we just have a little bit of time left before the break, about a minute, so I don't want to get into the next area of discussion. But when we come back, we want to delve into why we should be concerned, we humans, about bleached coral reefs and disappearing coral reefs and pteropods with quickly diminishing shells, and what that means for us, the human species, and most importantly, what we can do to break through the denial, how we can, as I said before we went on air, make a copy of this article on recycled content paper, of course, and pass it out to every American, make it required reading, because you cannot digest this information and not be alarmed. So we're going to find out maybe some of the response that Elizabeth is getting to her series of articles in the New Yorker magazine. Pick it up if you can find it. It's the November 20th edition, Underwater Apocalypse, Our Acidifying Seas and What They Mean to You and Me. We'll be right back.
Just wait, tell you something's wrong. It's nature's wait, tell you in a song. It's nature's way of saving you. It's nature's way of retrieving you.
Back to Eco Talk. I'm Betsy Rosenberg speaking with Elizabeth Culbert. She has written not only a series of articles for the New Yorker magazine about global warming and all its impacts, and we're still, of course, unraveling all that, but she has told me during the break that she's compiled them, in fact, into a book called Field Notes from a Catastrophe. So where can folks find that book? Because it's critical reading.
Anywhere, I hope. I hope online, Barnes & Noble online, Amazon online, but also I hope in most bookstores.
Anywhere fine books are sold. Good. Important books. So when we were going to the break, I was wondering aloud, you know, so what if folks who are listening say, well, that's too bad about those sea creatures losing their shells and their armor and the coral reefs, but really in the big scheme of things, I got other things to worry about. Why should we stop, take pause, and not only worry, but, do something?
Well, I really think that the lesson, you know, everything that we've learned over the last 100 years about biology has taught us that we are part of this complicated web of relationships. And when you talk to biologists about this, they'll say, look, it's possible you can sort of get rid of a lot of creatures, and we are in the process of doing that, I have to say. And it's possible that human life will continue merrily on its way. But it's also possible that there are things that we just can't anticipate. There are creatures that we're dependent on in ways that we just can't anticipate, and that it will have huge effects on humans. So if you're only worried about humans even, then you ought to be very concerned. And on the other hand, I would like to, raise an alarm for the sake of these marvelous organisms with whom we share the planet. I don't really see how we can ignore their plight. It seems to me the world is an amazing place and a diverse place, and we're kind of ripping that to shreds. And it seems to me, as a human being, one ought to be rather alarmed about that.
Yes, I was reading the article, as often is the case, and I'm sure for many of you listening, my anger was just welling up inside that whoever and however this incredible web of life was created, that the brilliance of it is astounding and almost too big for words. And yet we humans, by fueling Mother Nature, are really messing it all up pretty quickly.
I think that the thing that really comes through when you talk to people and look back at the geological record, as people are sort of trying to look for precedents for some of the things that we're doing, and you have to go back many, many, many millions of years to find them, is nature tends to change very, very, very slowly, and we are changing it very, very, very quickly. And there's just no way that most ecosystems can adapt to that.
So we humans, of course, are not nearly smart enough to have created all this or anything close, but are we smart enough to stop the destruction of it?
That, is the big question. I think you've really put your finger on it. We're smart enough to have created, these means of destruction, and we're smart enough at this point to know what we are doing. All the information that we need is out there. And the question, the real question, is if we're smart enough to avoid the worst effects. And that's an open question at this point.
So what has been the response to your articles?
The response has been, good if you want to say, that people have responded very passionately to them and said, you know, I think that they have affected a lot of people. But, you know, on the other hand, you know, non-existent, if you want to say, has the world really changed? You know, as a writer, you do hope to really affect policy in some ways if an issue is as important as this. And I can't say that's really happened yet.
And how do you deal with knowing what you know, which is too much, as I say sometimes, and what's going on or what has not gotten on politically at the national level, certainly, that, you know, if you read the science, we need to, you know, start reversing the trend yesterday, and we're not even doing right. that yet as Greenland melts and the glaciers fall into the ocean and species die. How do you get up and smile, and I bet you have some kids to hug, you know, and get through your day?
Yeah, well, it's not easy. My message is not one of everyone should be happy. My message is, since I have a message besides, you know, the bare reality of it all, is that I think people should be pretty upset. And I can only hope, you know, that upset, as you put it at the beginning of the show, translates into some kind of action. I can't tell you everything's going to be okay, and I would have to say I'd be, you know, pretty foolish, knowing you know what I've learned from the many scientists I've talked to over the last 2 years. You know, no one can offer that assurance. We have to act in the face of a lot of uncertainties, in the face of a lot of damage that's already been done. I think we still have an obligation, as you say, to our kids to do the best we can.
And we just have a minute left, but at the end of the article, you say that in some ways the oceans have already saved us, we humans and other land animals. Maybe we can end on a sort of positive note with that. what do you
right.
mean by that?
Well, one reason I think that people have been slow to sort of look at the effects of CO2 on the oceans is because the oceans are a huge sink for CO2, and that's really been helpful in the sense of, you know, all the CO2 that stays in the air translates into temperature rise. So people have thought, great, you know, there's a lot of CO2 going into the oceans. That CO2 we don't have to worry about in the air. The unfortunate part is that now we're learning increasingly that we've got to worry about it if it's in the air, and we've got to worry about it if it's in the oceans, and there's no good place to be putting all the CO2.
That's sort of a good news, bad news note to end on.
Exactly.
Well, I want to thank you from the bottom of my green heart, Elizabeth Colbert, for all your incredible work, environmental journalist and author of a series of articles in The New Yorker, also a book you can go out and get anywhere. I highly recommend it.